Having been a practicing programmer for 10 years before moving into management, our guest today, Ann Lewis, has worked across a variety of industries, including e-commerce, medical, city planning, education, and politics. Along her journey, she's earned a bachelor's in computer science from Carnegie Mellon and has held titles like software engineer, engineering manager, director of engineering, and my personal favorite, Ruby on Rails web ninja. These days, Anne is the chief technology officer of MoveOn.org, a nonprofit working in the political space. Be sure to stay tuned as we catch up with Anne Lewis and hear not only about her move to the C-suite from engineering, but also what it's like to work for a nonprofit.
You're listening to the Developmentor podcast, hosted by Grant Ingersoll. We have one goal on the show, to help you build a successful career in tech, no matter where you're from or where you're going. We do this by showcasing interesting people working across a variety of roles in tech and deep dive into their why. If you want to learn more, please visit our website at developmentor.com or follow us on Twitter at @developmentor.
Hey, Anne, welcome to the show.
Hi, Grant. Thanks for having me on.
I trust all is well with you. I know, it's almost become a broken record for me in recording this, but I do like to always check in with my guests up front. I know we're, even though this will air, it is August right now when we're recording this. This will probably air in October, but I trust you're doing well, at least as well as can be with all that's going on in the world.
Yep. I would say that I'm at peace with my pandemic life.
If I'm not mistaken, you folks at MoveOn were fairly remote before all of this even started. Is that right?
Yeah, MoveOn has actually been remote for over 20 years. And I personally have been working remotely for 10 years. So that part of my life isn't different. Initially by accident and then on purpose once I realized how much more productive you can be in a remote environment.
Yeah, it's amazing how addicting. I know my first probably 6 months of remote, I was like, God, what have I gotten into? And then I was like, I'm never going back. Well, real quick, maybe for our listeners, what's one or two power tips for the expert remote worker that you are?
Well, with software engineering, managers need to understand how to gauge team progress by actually looking at artifacts of work done as opposed to seeing whether people are physically in the office. And this actually works better for software engineering because you're actually looking at understanding and appreciating the engineer's work. So that's one tip for managers. And we've been using some version of Agile and MoveOn and at the other places that I've worked at remotely. And so I think that adapts really well to a remote environment. We have stand-up meetings, sprint plannings, we track our tasks in sprints and in a backlog, and all of those things become very clear visions of what's happening now and what's coming up in the future.
Communication, asynchronous communication. Who would have known in the remote world that that's what powers it, right? No, that's fantastic. Well, so let's dive in here then, and I would love for you to take our listeners back to those early days and tell us your origin story with tech. What got you into the field and such that you decided to go pursue it at Carnegie Mellon?
I guess this is sort of a non-traditional story. When I was in ninth grade, a significant percentage of people in my high school matriculated into the United States Army. And so they made all the ninth graders take the Army aptitude test that would supposedly place you into your ideal role in the Army. And so everyone else got their reports back with interesting Army jobs. And my report back said, your ideal position in the Army is don't join the Army, become an engineer. And this was before the internet. So I asked my teachers, what's an engineer? I asked my parents. They didn't know. They thought maybe a train engineer. I eventually did find out what engineering was. And I've always loved math and science and building things and taking things apart and tinkering with things. So I decided I wanted to be some kind of engineer. And I discovered computer programming when I was in high school. Everyone in my pre-calculus class had to buy a TI-86 graphing calculator, if you remember those. I discovered that there's a really rudimentary basic-based programming language built into that calculator, and I discovered I could use it to solve some of the math problems that we were working on and make animations, and I thought that was really neat. I initially thought maybe it would be fun to be a video game programmer, But then when I discovered programming in general, I realized that you can move at the speed of thought and build things as quickly as you can imagine them. And I've been excited about that for my entire life. So that's why I decided to major in computer science.
Well, and so, you know, I think coming out of Carnegie Mellon, you went straight into the workforce. And if I recall correctly, look from your profile, you went to Amazon. Is that right?
Yeah, that was my first job after college.
And you were there for something like 4 or 5 years, I think. And so I'm curious, you know, what was that experience like? This wasn't early days of Amazon, but kind of mid-level. And I'm curious, what was your experience there, like working at this place that was basically a rocket ship and working there as a software engineer?
Well, in the early 2000s, I think Amazon's identity was largely based around having survived the dot-com bubble burst. A lot of other tech companies had gone under. So Amazon survived, so did Google and Microsoft. They were hiring up all the engineers right out of college. And there's a lot of pride around doing things efficiently. At that time, they had something called the Door Desk Award, where if you figured out a better way of architecting a system that empowered other engineers or other workers, you got this tiny little door desk. But the origin of that story was that apparently Bezos and I think Jeff Holden and some of the other early execs were by hand fulfilling orders to the early Amazon website, which were I think mostly books at that point. And they were kneeling on the floor doing all this wrapping up of packages, like manually doing this the systems that they would later automate. And their knees hurt. So they were like trying to figure out how they could fulfill all these orders without hurting their knees more. And one executive suggested knee pads, and the other one suggested we should have a table. So they frugally built a table out of an old door. And when I was working there, all of the engineer desks were made out of doors. And that sort of like brilliant idea of like, no, here's a way of doing it better, that became the Door Desk Award. So that's a little bit about their culture. I think there were 600 engineers when I started and 2,000 engineers when I left. So they just started that period of meteoric growth.
Well, and I'm curious, what were, you know, maybe one or two key lessons you learned while you were there? Because, I mean, you know, I imagine watching an organization like that scale has got to be a pretty, you know, you got a front row seat on that, right?
Yeah, it was exciting in good and bad ways, to be honest. There was a lot of turnover at the time because the work environment was incredibly stressful. And at the time, this was before iPhones, we had to carry these physical pagers and be on call for website issues. So I think the average tenure at the time was maybe 9 months. They like to measure everything. Metrics is a big part of the culture. So they had this tool called the old fart tool, which is the percentage of people who were hired after you started. And I think after 4 years, I was at 90% in the old fart tool. I got really good at code archaeology, inheriting a couple of systems that a series of engineers before me had built and then rebuilt and then rebuilt. So you have to get good at like at reading and understanding code, even if there's no documentation and no one remembers how a system works anymore. And that's a skill I've used for my entire career. Amazon's also deeply metrics driven. So each team ideally would have a fitness function that would define its value to the company. Although, as everybody there learned, if you're tracking click streams to purchase through the website, then there are certain points in the click stream that many, many groups share a surface area on, like the product detail page, for example. And it's hard to measure the value of some teams without causing expensive outages that, you know, while measuring the value based on lost money is also not the best way of measuring things. But the idea that you can measure everything and drive towards metrics, that's a powerful set of ideas. I think the trick is making sure the metrics you use are right and also like honor the humanity of the people working there. So I've actually taken some of these ideas of driving with metrics, but swapped in my current role, metrics that I believe are in line with my own progressive values.
Yeah, I love that. I want to come back to that as now that you're in a leader, we'll come back to that in a moment. But you turned a phrase there that I don't think I've had any guest on the show turn before, which is code archaeology. Explain that a little bit more. And I love it because this is something I've always been fascinated with. But tell me a little bit more and maybe, you know, give one or two examples of tips or a problem you had to solve doing that.
The problem I solved that I was most proud of at Amazon was fighting off the multicast packet storms of 2005. And the situation around this was that some system architects at Amazon had identified that to be able to create a lot of software very quickly, that they needed to adopt some sort of service-oriented architecture. So prior to this, Amazon was, not kidding, a single statically linked executable written in C. Yes. So a lot of the work that was happening during the time when I was there was breaking out the C monolith. If you can imagine First of all, like building a website that is a statically linked C executable, good for you. You are brave. If you could imagine like 500 developers trying to share a testing and deployment pipeline with like one monolith, it was just as fraught as you could imagine. So breaking that out into a service-oriented architecture involved finding your team's C and C++ code that in theory you own and kind of extracting it from the monolith and then rebuilding it in its own server and database that feeds data back to a shared front end. So that was the work involved. Initially, the one idea behind the Amazon service-oriented architecture of the early 2000s was to use a multicast protocol for servers in the ecosystem to communicate with each other. And this is a nice theoretical idea because like services can come online and send messages and receive messages and go offline and they don't have to register configuration with each other. But the growth was so massive and there were so many services sending each other so many messages that at one point we actually reached a point where the Cisco router tables were about to fill up. And then some network engineers noticed this and called Cisco and asked what would happen if this happened. And they were like, wow, we have no idea. That's never happened before. So Bezos basically declared, guess what? We're all moving to a request reply protocol instead of multicast. You all have to start migrating now. You have to be done by the end of the year. The last teams to migrate have to be the owners of the monolith that was also like constantly paging people and having all kinds of problems. So that was terrifying, but also motivating. So I did this migration work for the customer reviews system. And here's where the code archaeology comes in. There had been so many owners of this code base over the years. Some of them, you could tell which were the original owners because that code was written in C. And then along the way, other developers had tried to incorporate more C++ idioms. And there's always someone who's trying to add STL to the ecosystem. But then the developer that comes after that, that either doesn't understand or conscientiously objects to STL. So you can kind of see in the change sets which business decisions happened when, which were reversed, because you can never really take back a business decision. It gets encoded in your data model and your software forever. And you can see the real cost of turnover, to be honest. I succeeded at this migration at exactly the right time before the Christmas rush started. So it used to be true that the majority of Amazon traffic came from the US English-speaking Christmas consumer buying cycle. This was before Amazon was more global and did more things. So we managed to get that migration done and the detail page that contained the reviews widget scaling just in time. And so that felt like lots of victory. But I think I wouldn't have been able to do it if I hadn't been able to read lots of other people's code and tinker with it and try to really understand how it worked and why it was there. It's very easy sometimes to look at other developers' code and be like, pshaw, I would have done it differently. But like you hardly ever have the luxury of rewriting things to your own specifications or comfort level. So getting comfortable with being uncomfortable and understanding and accepting other people's idioms, I think is one of the keys to getting stuff done quickly.
Yeah, I love that. Well, and and oftentimes you are that former developer, right? Like, yeah, you're even like, I know, like doing archaeology on my own code, like several years later can be a pain. Well, so then, after Amazon, I think, you spent a number of years in some other software engineering companies, I think, including that having that ninja title, which is amazing. I got to know the story behind that, but I also want to know, like, what are some of those key inflection points of as you were in this software engineering role, and then I'll come on to management here in a minute. But tell me a bit more about kind of the next few phases of software engineering for Anne after Amazon.
At Amazon, I, without meaning to, got deep experience in massively scalable distributed systems, which. It's really interesting because Amazon has so much, these big tech companies have so much data and so much scale. I mean, even the smallest system you can build is going to have to handle thousands of requests a second. So that's a whole other interesting engineering problem. But I found myself getting more and more curious about systems I could build from the ground up myself or being part of a smaller team and being able to do more individually. So I started to chase interesting startup ideas around. The Ruby on Rails Web Ninja job was at a startup that doesn't exist anymore. They wanted to build a database of consumer and product information that would allow consumers to make choices in line with their values when they tried to buy something. So in theory, we'd build a database of all the environmental, social, and economic impacts related to the product that you were buying and how it was created and shipped to you. Yeah, so it was a Bay Area startup and they had flashy titles. So my title of that job was Ruby on Rails Web Ninja. And as a part of that job, I negotiated nunchucks as a part of my compensation. this was a joke. I didn't think, but when I showed up on my first day, there were like nunchucks on the table. I was like, oh, great. I still have them. And so to me, this is my, like, the moral of the story is always ask for what you want. You never know if you might get it.
Were they company branded?
No, they were real nunchucks. They were padded, fortunately, as the engineers tried to play with them and we kept knocking ourselves in the head with them by accident. Turns out watching Teenage Ninja Turtles does not prepare you to use nunchucks.
Oh, come on. The skills are real there. That's one lesson, you know, ask for what you want, because if you don't ask, you don't get it. What are perhaps some other things that came along the way? I heard in there also this, you've mentioned twice now, values. You know, is that starting to emerge for you at this time?
It was, yeah. I was noticing the tech industry growing bigger and more powerful and offering more and more services to society. But along with that power comes responsibility inherently. But I saw a lot of variation in how engineering leaders or company leaders used the power that they had. And I started to get involved in different kinds of activism, including pretty early on helping advocate for the rights of H-1B visa workers. There are lots of H-1B visa holders in software engineering. And some companies treat their workers with respect and pay everyone a market salary. Other companies I discovered in my journey through startups do not, and intentionally hire H-1B visas workers and work them harder and pay them less and you know, intentionally exploit them. As I learned more and more about, you know, what's possible for companies and people, I decided I have to be working in a role where I'm doing work that's in line with my values. And so this took me from startup to startup. I won't say which one this was, but I protest quit one startup for exploiting H-1B visa workers and then helped all but one of them find another better job with a company that would sponsor their visa and handle the paperwork and not threaten their family, but also treat them with the respect that they deserved. And I also learned that at smaller companies, you're really, the tone and the work environment and the values of the company are very dependent on your leader. So it's important to choose which leaders you trust and work for carefully, because the impact of your work as a software engineer is incredibly high. So you want to be spending that time on something that I believe that you believe in, or that has value that is in line with your values.
This is one of the things about software, obviously a huge amount of impact. We also often many folks are in a position to have some leverage in software. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot of the current movement of people in software working to enact change here. So I think it's fantastic that you highlight. I'm also even just curious, like maybe it's a little too gossipy, but the protest quit, I mean, that's a tough move to make regardless, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, you still have to put food on the table yourself as well. So that's a tricky one for a lot of people to navigate. I'm curious how that went for you.
Well, I was in my early 20s and was not responsible for anyone but myself. And I was betting on, I can definitely find another job. And the world is actually quite big. And there were never any negative consequences of that, although I worried about that at the time. But I think, you know, engineers have a lot more leverage and negotiating power than we realize sometimes. We're used to being told what to do and having a, you know, Dilbert-style pointy-haired boss who's in charge. But you know, the reason why software engineers are so highly paid is because the work we do has even greater value for the people employing us. And so with that, I think comes a lot of leverage that we can use as a force for good if we recognize that we have that power.
I keep deferring kind of some of these later questions around nonprofits and things like that, which we'll get to. Not sure how to ask for that raise at work? Perhaps you're perplexed on whether you should change careers or not. Maybe you're debating whether you should get another degree. Or perhaps you're not quite sure how to negotiate for equity at your startup. Listen up, because we here at Developmentor are launching a new topic-based episode format that'll air once a month as a bonus to our usual interviews. In each episode, our panel will tackle the toughest topics in building a successful career in tech, as well as discuss listener-submitted questions, all with the goal of providing you deeper insights into how to navigate your career in tech. So if you have a question on your career that you'd like answered, drop us a note and we just might answer your question on air. Head over to developmentor.com/questions and fill out the form to submit your question, or you can drop us an email at hello@developmentor.com. If your question is chosen to be read on air, we'll send you a thank you gift. Be sure to hit subscribe on your favorite podcast player to catch our new monthly bonus episodes, as well as all of our regularly scheduled interviews. You know, Sven, I think at this point, then you made the transition. I believe at Rosetta Stone, you made that leap into management, if you will. Maybe leap's not the right way to characterize it, but you made the change into management. And I'm curious, you know, where were you at, and what was your process for deciding, okay, I'm ready for management, or you fell into management like some of our guests have? Like, what was that like for you at that point in time?
It was an interesting experience. To be honest, I avoided going into management for many years, even after I reached a point where I was maybe ready, because I had a mentor early on in my career at Amazon who told me something along the lines of, "Anne, you're female. You seem reasonable, like you have a reasonable personality. Someone will try and promote you into management at some point, but don't do this because managers are completely useless." I wrote this down and carefully adhered to this for 10 years. And I realized later, that's not only wrong, it's also kind of sexist. And by accepting that, I had kind of accepted some toxic aspects of tech culture just to sort of get along and get by. First of all, it was not true that I had excellent communication skills simply from being female. I had to carefully develop those over many, many years. Still working on that. There's kind of an old school programmer idea that the engineers are all gods, that no one else understands them, and the people who don't understand them are stupid. The end. You know, maybe in the early 90s, it was possible for a single human to build a system that had incredible value by themselves. And then as the system grew, it only ever needed one human to take care of it. That's just not really true anymore. You have to work with groups of people to get anything of value done now. And, managers who make it possible for engineers to do great work and then give them credit for that work, that's an incredibly valuable thing to do that many people are actually not very good at. So I very begrudgingly stepped into a management role when my manager had left and then his manager had left, and they just desperately needed managers. And I realized that no matter how productive I could be on a given day, if I can create the conditions for 10 or 15 or 20 people to be productive and happy and respected, working on the right things at the right time, that's actually a huge force multiplier. And it's also really rewarding, especially directly managing other software engineers. As someone who's been a software engineer, you can really understand what they're doing. And when they have intellectual victories or solve a really hard problem, you can appreciate them deeply. A lot of engineers are used to mostly, being treated like a resource, but not ever really deeply understood or appreciated. And so being able to do that for an engineering team is great. So I wish I'd gone into it a little bit earlier. But I'm very excited right now about creating excellent software engineering teams where everyone can thrive and everyone has meaningful work and is respected for it.
Yeah, I love the way you frame that. I think I had an earlier episode with one of my personal friends, Chris Bouton, and he said to me one day, he's like, "Grant, do you want to be the one who implements your idea, or do you want to see your ideas implemented?" And, and I think you're extending that even more. This is a team sport. You can't just fashion this out of thin air, right? Even if you do start with a germ of an idea that one person can do, you're never going to get there by yourself. So then I'm curious, that first time as a manager, that can be both incredibly rewarding, like you said, but also can be pretty rough. What are some of those key lessons from being a first-time manager?
So in the same way that code complexity compounds if you have too many authors and too much turnover, management and product planning complexity can compound in a similar way. So when I stepped into a software engineering manager role, I was responsible for, I think it was 12 people working on a couple different projects. I discovered that some of the projects were not at all well scoped out, and the engineers were just spending a lot of time treading water and dealing with uncertainty. And then when I started to escalate, where is the plan? Who's in charge of the plan? No, seriously, what's the plan? I discovered all kinds of other management dysfunctionality that then became a whole other problem to solve. How can you extract requirements out of people who are afraid to make decisions, or maybe there's some sort of political conflict going on? Ultimately, what you're trying to solve for is making sure your engineers are working on the right work at the right time in the right order. And there's actually a lot of work that needs to happen to get to that point. But one of the biggest lessons I learned was, in addition to product complexity or planning complexity compounding, conflict avoidance is also can get really, really toxic. So one of my very first management challenges when I first became a manager, in my very first one-on-one with one of my engineers, the engineer came to me and said, "Hey, I have this problem and I was wondering if you could help me with it." And I was like, yes, I will help you with your problem. What is it? Assuming it would be some really hard technical thing. And he said, well, there's this other engineer who has been coming into work drunk every day and harassing people, but he harasses me really, really badly. Can you do something about this? And I was like, oh my God, yeah, of course. Like, not only is it wrong, it's also called out on page 35 of the employee handbook that you cannot drink at work. So I investigated this. I found that, in fact, this person had been bringing vodka in these plastic water bottles and leaving them around his desk, and you could smell it. And I went up to HR and said, hey, there's a person who's been coming into work drunk, definitely for the last couple of weeks, folks say maybe for the last year. Please reprimand and fire this person. And HR said, oh, okay, we'll look into that. I was like, okay, nothing happened. And I waited, a couple of weeks went by. I went back to HR and said, hey, did you look into that employee coming into work drunk and harassing other employees? Like, we're a publicly traded company. This is a huge liability. You really need to act on this. And they're like, oh yeah, okay, we're looking into it. Another couple of weeks went by, and then I started to escalate more aggressively. It's like, the engineer who is being harassed is going to quit. I don't want that to happen, and I also don't want this company to be at risk of any lawsuits. You really need to do something about this. And you know what HR told me? You know, it's really hard to hire engineers. So they didn't want to launch another hiring, but like, this person was showing up doing measurably, not just zero work, but negative work in preventing other people from doing work. That's evidence of a lot of problems.
For a public company too, like, that's a time bomb waiting to go off there. Yeah.
Stories like this are not uncommon though. I mean, I have found the tech industry is great at telling its heroic war stories, and you know, it advantages all of us to have the media constantly refer to us as geniuses who are brilliant and generating so much value and can do no wrong. When you have environments that are really homogenous, that don't have fair or even very intentional hiring processes, you know, in every team of 10, maybe you have one or two people who are doing a lot of work and carrying projects over the finish line, but you also have a lot of people who are kind of not doing a lot. And this is part of what motivated me to get into more equitable hiring processes and diversity and inclusion efforts. For the first 10 years of my career, you know, I was often the only woman in the room, but I figured, whatever, I'll just, you know, I'll be that model minority. I'll be a good example. I'll work harder than everyone else. If someone says something sexist to me, I'll just, you know, prove them wrong. But it's not just an individual personality conflict thing when you deal with things like sexism and racism and discrimination in all of its forms. There's this negative side effect that the people who benefit from whatever stereotypes are in play by decision makers, some of them can get away with pretty terrible behavior, like this drunk engineer, and there's really very little accountability around it. So when you make environments intentionally more equitable, you also make them more competitive because, you know, there's accountability and it's harder for engineers to coast. It's harder for engineers to have like toxic behavior like this drunk person. It's very complicated. There's this like dark underbelly of, I think, homogenous workplace environments.
I think all of us all have like that, hey, I worked in a toxic place. And I'm trying to think if there was anybody who showed up drunk. I don't think so. But it was the kind of place that some people would come in and they would quit after like 2 hours because they were like, oh my God, how do you people work in this environment? This is crazy. But it was also a rough environment. You know, it wasn't like the same boom. We were in a smaller town and there just wasn't as many opportunities. So people tolerated just a lot of bad behavior because you needed a job. Well, so I'm curious then, you know, like, how did you start to develop actual skills in that realm, right? Like, because, you know, it's one thing that you've got your values aligned to it, but bringing that into a practice as a manager, you know, there's art and science to it, right? You know, what did you do to develop that? What are some examples and some tips for our listeners that they can take away to help them be better managers or better employees when it comes to diversity and inclusion and fairness at the workplace?
So I initially assumed that as a woman, albeit a white woman, that I experienced being a minority with respect to a dominant culture and that maybe I understood what the problem was and how to fix it. That's a logical fallacy. It's important to realize that we all only know our own experience. And so that makes us blind to the experience of people who are different from us. We can individually embark on, you know, a 7-year quest to get a PhD and all the different ways in which, you know, human beings oppress each other in society. Or we can assume that we don't know enough. And probably the most effective thing that I've found for myself and personally, and also for organizations, is to do what's called anti-oppression training. There are many different consultants and companies that provide this service. I think the more hands-on you can get, and the more hours of trainings you sign up for, the better everyone will be. But this helps teams individually start from wherever they are and gain an intersectional lens on how power and privilege manifest in society and how they might be sometimes the winners of those power systems and sometimes the losers and what that means. It takes a lot of learning to get to a point where you can really see all of the problems. And, you know, as an engineer, if you can't see the problem, you can't solve the problem. So that's where I would recommend starting. I personally took a longer and more meandering route through this, first learning more about gender dynamics and then also learning more about racial dynamics, which as a white person, I had a lot of learning to do. And then, you know, there's a whole world of intersectional oppression dynamics from a variety of different perspectives on identity. This sounds cliche, but just to sort of like understand that you're starting from like a beginner's mind and that you have a lot to learn and being open to that learning, I think that's the most important thing to do.
And for our listeners, we'll try to link up some resources here as well for people to start on this journey. You know, it's one of those things that you're never done learning either. And I think that's that beginner's mind that you're talking about. Well, so then coming back to your career, I mean, great tips in there. But, you know, so you work your way up to CTO, you're at MoveOn. I'm curious, you know, was that your goal? Like, how had you been thinking about your career to date? And how did you think about, like, climbing the ladder, if it were, as it were, however? What was Anne's approach to career at this point is probably a more succinct way to say it.
It took me maybe 10 years to start thinking about wanting to become a tech lead or a VP of engineering or a CTO role. And initially, like, so I got into software engineering just because I love programming. I love building things. I love piecing things together. I love debugging. But then I began to realize that what I really loved about this was problem solving as applied to programming. And then I started to think about software management as problem solving as applied to people and systems. And the more I began to get to know other people at that level and the director level and the C level, I realized, you know, everybody's just a person and they're all just doing the best that they can. No one's perfect. I have yet to meet a, you know, pure unadulterated genius as opposed to just a regular person trying to figure out what to do next and what to tell everyone the plan is. And I realized that even though I was super intimidated about taking this step into engineering leadership in this way, I really wanted to do it because I really, really care about making the world more fair. And the more power you have to decide who gets hired, which systems get built, what systems to empower a program with versus not, what to automate, the more leadership you take on, the more ability you have to execute a vision. I don't have like a specific vision for the world, but I really care about figuring out what's unfair and fixing it. And so I realized that taking a role at a high profile organization like MoveOn that has been remote and has been digitally powered for 20 years and building the next generation of tech systems and data systems and tools, there's a lot of power there to empower the campaigners and the organizers doing this advocacy and organizing work to make their ideas a reality. And that was really exciting because I've had a deep respect for people who work at nonprofits and organizers in particular for making change happen. And I really wanted to understand how that worked. And I thought of it as magic when I first started here, but then I began to realize that they're doing problem solving too. They just have different tools and they have different systems of people that they work with. But there's actually a lot of similarity there.
Well, and I'm curious then, I think you hinted at this with the finishing of that sentence, which was, you know, what changed for you when you were now in the C-suite? You know, you're the one calling the quote unquote technical shots, although I know it never really works that way, but let's just assume it does. You know, what changed for you once you entered that role?
The first thing was the fire hose of communication. So when you're holding power in a particular organization, you are the entry point of all ideas, relationships, problems, opportunities, and it's a fire hose of communication. So I had to very quickly become a fast reader and writer to keep up with all these wordy political people. Then I also had to figure out, given these various fire hoses of people asking for things or things breaking or opportunities or people wanting to talk about things, which categories of requests needed to be systems, are problems that needed to be systematized or needed investment in infrastructure to make possible, which sort of like forward-looking infrastructural investments I needed to make, what things to pay attention to and what to not. And I think the higher you get in leadership roles, what you choose to pay attention to has a huge, huge impact. Because if you're aware of a problem and you have budget and you can invest in a solution, that's huge. Or if you can tell people, your team, yes, go solve this problem, that's huge. But figuring out what to pay attention to, given this, like, again, I'm just saying it again, fire hose, is actually quite difficult. So that's the sort of like communication and time management. That was the first big learning curve that I had. The second set of things, challenges that I faced was that MoveOn was in the process of trying to figure out what to do with its legacy infrastructure. And I love upgrading legacy systems. I don't know. I sort of like fell into that at Amazon, and I've been doing that at every job I've been at since then, just because systems and tools and languages and frameworks get more and more powerful every couple of years, but the cost of migration is high. So most organizations are in a place where their systems are not as powerful as they could be or not as efficient as they could be. They're always facing this choice of when to upgrade. So I got to make some of those decisions for MoveOn in 2015. And many of the decisions that me and my team made at that time have really, really paid off. So that's exciting to stick around for 5 years and be able to see that, in particular, our investment in data warehousing.
Wow, that's fantastic. Because, you know, I think what's the average lifespan of a CTO at a tech company is like 18 months, or at least I've heard that. So being able to see it through, and now you're making those same legacy decisions about your own legacy decisions, right? No, that's fantastic. I mean, the fire hose is so real. I'm just smiling here, and I'm like, oh, yeah.
I bet you have a fire hose, I'm guessing.
I think my last place, it kind of ebbed and flowed, and then here it is at Wikimedia. I mean, it's internal, external, it's world, as I think our head of product says, you know, if it happens in the world, it happens on Wikipedia. And so that creates an incredible fire hose. But it's so true. Well, and for me, I don't know if this is true for you, but like the fire hose isn't clean either, if you know what I mean. In other words, there's people who sometimes will explicitly put things into the fire hose to dissuade you or to throw you off, or they're malicious about it even. And so figuring out the weights to apply to the communication channels and all of that is an incredibly complex process as well, you know, especially when you inherit an organization or you go in, right?
Definitely. Yeah. So I've thought about this in terms of algorithms, because that's the only way I can cope with getting 800 emails a week. So I took my email fire hose and I filtered it into different tiers of like point people that I need to respond to within 20 minutes, things that I can respond to within a day, and things that I can explore over the next couple of weeks. So I used a series of Gmail filters to implement my email filtering algorithm. But yeah, like stepping into an organization that was 15 years old and had 15 years worth of legacy decisions and systems and lore and history, it took a long time to get enough context to feel confident that I was making the right decisions. And so since there was an existing budget and system and structure, I started with the budget and I went through and for every single line item, figured out who knew where this came from and what the decision was, to kind of like unpack some of the history of business decisions. And then that led me down a path of figuring out who had owned or knew about which things that had happened in the past, because political organizations are like, they move very quickly. They're kind of like lightning fast startups almost. To be able to have an impact, you need to be able to recognize when breaking news happens and within 24 or 48 hours have a response or an action or a thing that you do to sort of like be a part of the conversation. So that meant that there was a lot of fast and loose tech that had been built before to make it just possible to take a particular tech-empowered action when the thing happened. So some of that stuff was only relevant in the past and could be sunset. Some needed to be carried forward in the future. And then some little bits of things realized were actually representing a need for a bigger infrastructural play that empowered like a whole ecosystem of doing this particular action versus a series of one-offs. But I think as a new leader in any organization, doing a lot of listening is probably the most valuable thing you can do to understand what's the context here, what mattered, what worked in the past, what didn't. And a lot of the people who've been there for years are really eager to tell their stories. And so that's really important to find all those folks and learn as much as you can and then start making some of the bigger decisions.
I'm still in that process of the listening tour, and there's archaeology upon archaeology. Well, so then I'm curious, I don't talk politics on the show, but I do think it's fair game to talk about the state of tech in politics, which is, spend a moment sharing your thoughts on the state of tech in politics. How do you approach building tech to support a political movement? And for our listeners who might want to get into it, what would they expect to find if they're going to show up as an engineer or some other part of a technical organization as part of a broader political movement?
Well, what I like to tell folks is that it feels like the fast-paced and empowering, being able to just sit down and build a thing when you see the opportunity, that kind of feeling that you would see in a tech startup. But you experience the scale and architecture challenges of a medium-sized or large-sized tech company, because with the way that the attention economy works right now, most of the time attention is spread over various trending topics within the social media news amplified ecosystem. But once in a while, something will go viral, or you'll hit like the resonant frequency of emotional attention, and everyone will be paying attention to this one thing. And if you can capture those moments and build the right tool or the right press release or the right set of actions that people who are motivated want to take, you can have like this amazing impact, but incredible scale that most of our political tech systems were not built to handle. So really interesting scaling problems to happen. I would say that it's very exciting, it's very rewarding, but also it's a very messy ecosystem. Political tech as an ecosystem has a relatively small market cap, so there's often not enough organic competition to make it so that there's a good product offering for each price point and each thing that needs to happen. There are some accidental monopolies with big platform systems that are just harder and take more time for competitors to build. But there's a million and one canvassing apps. And every year there's I feel like five more canvassing apps pitch themselves to me. And it's like, canvassing's good, except during a pandemic, it's impossible.
And for our listeners, just real quick, canvassing apps, explain that a little bit more. What are those doing?
Yeah. So when you're trying to get people to remember to go out and vote, which is our focus at this time of year and on an election year, the thing that you can do that has the most measurable impact is to have people go door to door, knock on doors, and talk to other people and say, hey, nice to meet you. I just wanted to remind you that voting day is this day. And, would you consider voting for my candidate? And here's information about your local polling place. That human to human connection is the most likely way to influence people to remember to get out and vote. Taking these sort of like individual interactions and scaling them up involves an incredible amount of logistics, and that's where tech comes in. So if you have one person walking around their neighborhood, they can just go knock on every door. It's pretty simple and straightforward. But if you have 100 people and you drop them into a particular zip code, you'll need to figure out some way of dividing and conquering territory so that each person has their own area that they're working. And ideally, you'll want to make it so that they can walk from house to house, and that if they're a particular political leaning, that maybe they knock on doors of people who are more likely to be voting in that direction so that they don't get yelled at. So all of that involves what's called coming up with walk sheets, what's called cutting turf, where you take a geographic area and break it into segments that individuals or teams can cover. And then there's a whole lot of logistics involved in gathering the data that you get at the door. So you might just knock on the door and say, hey, remember to vote, or you might ask folks to donate to your organization, or you might ask them to sign a petition or take a survey. There's a lot of data that's being gathered that then needs to get mapped back into a central data repository. In political tech, probably each organization uses at least 5 or 6 systems that were not built to interoperate, and MoveOn is using more like 20 or 25. So a lot of the work that happens is in ferrying data back and forth between these systems. Sometimes you can convince vendors to build integrations with other vendors, and sometimes vendors will build APIs to make your job easier. But there's a whole lot of data integration that happens, because you can't really ever use, one lone canvassing app by itself. The data you gather has to feed back into your main CRM so that, if you're, it all gets reconciled together with users and then can be shared with, other event tracking or event management systems that you might use in your ecosystem. So that's a big component of it.
Yeah, so fascinating scaling and those kind of problems of slicing and dicing turf and all that, those are really hard software problems as well. So I would imagine if you're a data structure and engineer, like algorithms nerd type, you would, which is where I always like to work, that would be a lot of fun. I wanted to shift gears and kind of come back to management and get you on with your day here on the interview as well, which is, you've written a fair amount about team building in tech, and you have this great Medium article that we'll link to in the show notes called How to Build a Software Engineering Culture Where Everyone Can Thrive. And I wonder if you could just spend a moment sharing with our listeners one or two tips that really are helpful in building a good culture? I think you hit on probably some of them earlier, I'm going to guess, but try to make it a bit more actionable and give us some tips that can really help build a better culture.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I think using some components from the Agile system for work management is helpful. But I think probably the most important thing you can do to make sure your culture is working and your processes are working and your team feels heard and respected is to make sure that there are feedback loops in basically everything you do. So if you do a big project with your team, make sure that at the end of the project, everyone has a chance to debrief that project and give their feedback on what they think went well or what could be changed. Similarly, most sprint planning cadences end with a feedback loop of how did that sprint go? What can we do better? Letting your team co-create and evolve processes over time, I think, is critical for being as smart as a team as you can be. If you're the manager or you're the director or you're the CTO, you're not going to have time to solve every possible problem. But you also don't want to be the person who's bottlenecking every single decision. You really want to cultivate leaders on your team and give people real opportunity to own things and give your team the opportunity to evolve processes over time as they come up with, understanding of like when things are working or not and then ideas for fixing them. So that's one big thing. Let team members negotiate for process changes, maybe team culture changes. Make sure that you're open to those ideas and you're modeling for the rest of the team that it's okay to be wrong and it's okay to change your mind and it's okay to learn things and then evolve your processes over time. And then rewarding people who speak up and come up with ideas by calling them out and appreciating them and then actually implementing their ideas.
Yeah, fantastic. And that's great. And like I said, we'll be sure to link that up. I want to touch on, I promised it to the listeners at the beginning. I know, for myself, switching to work at a nonprofit also requires shifting some of the way I think about all of these things, right? There's different motivations for why people work at nonprofits. The time scales can be different. The technical challenges, the budgets, they're all different. I'm curious, how has that transition been for you? Like, what's it like for you working at a nonprofit?
I'm very aware of resource constraints at all times. Every single architecture choice or choice to adopt a system or not is a very careful build versus buy decision. While it's fun to build everything, it's pretty easy for a small team to create so many custom solutions that all of a sudden they're just doing maintenance all the time and they don't have the space to create new things or take opportunities as they arise. So I think it's helpful to think about budgeting in terms of time, money, and also complexity. So for a political nonprofit, in an election year, we often have an incredible amount of fundraising that is specific to that year. So I like to think of that as a time when we have more money than time to spend. And then off years or odd numbered years, we often have more time than money. So odd numbered years are good times to do migrations. Even numbered years are a good time to try out new innovations and see if you can catch that election scale. But having a complexity budget is also really important because you really want to make sure that your team can actually sustainably maintain the set of systems and obligations that they have. And every couple of years, you're going to have to figure out what's your legacy code this year? What do you need to cut back on so that your team can have the space to innovate in the future? This is always a really hard discussion because if you ask stakeholders or business owners, can I get rid of this shiny tool that you didn't know you had? Everyone always says no, but if you frame it, the choice to them in terms of a cost-benefit analysis where everybody has the same stake in it, it's not like, can I take away your toy? It's like, well, would you be willing to cut this toy in exchange for this many hours of a tech person embedding with your project next year? You don't know what ideas you're going to come up with in the future, but do you want the opportunity to automate them if you have a great idea? That becomes a different kind of negotiation. And also, as the tech leader, you can make these hard calls and just tell the organization, you know what, we're cutting back the system, we have to. So I think as long as you can sort of maintain the right balance between resources of time, money, and complexity, then you can evolve your team over time and make sure that you're set up to capture that next opportunity for innovation.
It just dawned on me. It never occurred to me, this whole odd versus even. Obviously, I get it the minute you said it, but like, what an interesting dynamic. It reminds me a little bit of an e-commerce world of, like you said, the holiday season, at least in the US, when there's big spikes. So everything kind of works on this January to August time frame, but I guess I hadn't thought about it in your landscape where it's odd versus even years. That's such an interesting dynamic. You know, shifting gears and kind of bringing it home here, and what's the best thing about being in an engineering leadership role, and what's the most challenging thing?
Well, the best thing is that you can make those hard calls that you know are right. So one of the first things I did at MoveOn was establish an open source policy where my team open sources systems and software by default, unless there's a good reason not to. As an engineer, there were so many times in the past when I wanted to use an open source library or open source my own library, and there were always, I thought, not very reasonable policies or process limitations around that. So being able to make it so that my engineers can contribute back to a larger movement ecosystem of software and tools, and then also get the credit from the open source community that they deserve when they build awesome things, I just made that call. So being able to make those hard calls when you are pretty sure that like this bet is a good bet, that's incredible and empowering. The hardest thing is you're never done. There's always more communication. There are always more decisions to make. There are always more trade-offs to calculate. And figuring out what the most important thing to pay attention to is a daily struggle. Every quarter, I come up with a new productivity management strategy that I think is really going to be the one that conquers the inbox. But that's a part of this job that is exhausting and hard, that I think is always going to be hard.
So the inbox bankruptcy approach, has it worked for you yet?
No, because every once in a while, I'll miss an email about some critical system that needs to get renewed. And if I don't jump on it, something bad will happen that only I can fix.
I don't know how many iterations I've gone through of email processing. I feel like I've got it pretty good, but it's still things that break all the time there. Well, that's fantastic. Maybe two more questions, which is I want you to put on your mentoring hat now. You know, you've worked across all these different industries. You've worked across a number of different roles. You know, what's your best career advice? What would you tell, you know, I don't know, 18-year-old Anne or somebody who wants to follow in your footsteps?
Just go for that next big opportunity. I think a lot of smart, low ego people who feel imposter syndrome, which I think is most of us, hesitate to go for the big next step or the big risky feeling opportunity because they're not sure if they'll be able to do well enough or be perfect enough. And nobody's perfect. Everybody tries their best. But those low ego leaders who will be making sure that they're getting the feedback they need to understand if they've done the right thing, if their teams are happy, if their projects are successful, those are exactly the kind of leaders that we want in C-level tech positions. But they're often the ones who wait the longest to actually take that step. So that would be my advice. Just go for it. And if you're afraid of it, consider yourself a scientist who has to test whether or not their hypothesis that being a CTO is too hard or a tech leader is too hard. Test that hypothesis and see if it's true before writing yourself off.
You know, I find this with a lot of leaders. I guess it makes sense, but, you know, applying that engineering thinking to people management while still holding true to the emotional side is, and the empathetic side and the compassionate side, that at the end of the day is the sweet spot. And so great to have you on the show. I know we've been trying to find overlapping times where we could schedule this. And I know, especially I'm sure for you being, we're about to move into heavy political season. I so very much appreciate you taking the time to join me. Final question for you, which is, you know, where can our listeners best connect with you, maybe follow you on social media, learn more about the path you've taken?
Follow me on Twitter. Ann_Lewis.
That's fantastic. And I know we'll link that up in our show notes. We'll link up that great Medium article from Ann and, as always, her LinkedIn profile. Ann, thank you again so much for joining me today. It was really great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Grant.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Developmentor podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Even better, please leave us a review. If you want to hear older episodes, leave feedback, or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at developmentor.com. If you'd like to support the show, there are three ways you can help out. 1. Make a donation via Patreon. 2. If you're a software engineer looking for your next gig and wanting to practice interviewing, use our referral link to the interviewing.io platform. And 3. Buy your next tech book from Manning Publications using our affiliate link. All of those links can be found at developmentor.com/support-us. That's support-us, all one word. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move one step closer to finding your path.